This is where we meet, sharing conversations from New Mexico and beyond. I'm Chelsea Reedy, and the show is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Today, Jacqueline Paul talks with Cindy Jaramillo and Christine Barber, the founders of Street Safe, a nonprofit organization in Albuquerque that advocates for unhoused women on the street, making a daily difference in their lives. Please note that this episode contains depictions of violence that some people may find disturbing or difficult to listen to. Here's Jacqueline Paul, followed by Cindy Jaramillo.
So I'd like to begin by asking how Street Safe got its start. How did it all begin?
Well, prior to 2009, me and Christine had met about doing a book. And while in the process of interviewing me to write the book, I had made a comment that I had wanted to start something to help the women because there was no one to help women back then in the situation of, you know, working the streets or being trafficked or in any part of the sex trade. And me and Christine talked about it, and we decided we were going to start something to help the women.
In 1999, Cindy was doing dates when a man claiming to be an undercover cop told her she was being arrested for the solicitation of sex and put her in the back of his car. This man was David Parker Ray, also known as the Toy Box Killer. Over 3 days, Cindy endured horrific acts and was able to escape. Her brave testimony contributed to his sentencing of 224 years in prison. He died in 2002, only 3 years into his sentence. In 2009, a woman walking her dog stumbled across a femur in Albuquerque's West Mesa. After that, 11 graves of women were discovered. The case remains unsolved. Here's Christine Barber.
So the West Mesa victims all disappeared in 2003-2004. So 11 women from the street community in Albuquerque went missing over the course of a year to a year and a half. And that's a lot of women to go missing from one community. Yet main so-called mainstream society in Albuquerque didn't even know about it until 2009. In February, when the bodies were actually found buried on the West Mesa. And so for people like me who didn't know about it, and for the public who didn't know about it, it was quite the shock to know that that many women had been killed by a serial killer, and none of us had known, yet the police knew, and women, certainly other women on the street knew. And so Cindy, rightly so, made a comment that, there just needed to be a group that was paying attention just to women, because the women on the street have really different needs and really different experiences. And from her experience on the street and also being kidnapped by a serial killer, she definitely had an interest in that and a big voice in that. And so just from that, I just remember her saying really clearly to me, there just needs to be a group that pays attention. And so we're like, okay, we can do that. And that's kind of how we got started.
Your group serves women on the street. And how does this program differ from other programs that serve women within the state of New Mexico and Albuquerque?
We specifically serve women who are in the sex trade. That includes it's a lot of women who are on Central selling sex on the street, and on the street is referred to as doing dates. That is a thing that happens throughout New Mexico. In the rural areas, it's happening in homes. It's happening all over the place. We're a group that helps in that situation, that if they decide they want to leave the life, and again, it's their choice. If they want to stay, we're there to support them. And if they want to leave, we're there to support them. But it's just another person who's watching out for them, because it's incredibly dangerous, especially doing dates on the street. We have mentioned now two different serial killers that have targeted women on Albuquerque streets. We don't just specify homeless. A lot of the women, if not the majority of women who do dates on the street, are homeless, but we specify in helping them with the whole, make sure they have condoms, make sure they have the supplies they need to be safe while they're out doing dates too.
Well, not necessarily do we help men or women in the sex trade.
Yes, very good point, Cindy. Sorry about that. You're right. Because we definitely have male victims and sex trafficking victims we have as well. And when we say women or even men, anybody who's trans, we mean trans women are women to us. It's not there's no differentiation.
And I kind of want to talk a little bit about the difference between doing dates and sex trafficking. So the federal government defines sex trafficking as any adult or minor forced by another person to sell sex, or any minor not forced by another person who is selling sex, quote, on their own, end quote. I know there are layers. I know it's such a gray area. And from working with the women on the street that are involved on all sides of this, can you describe the difference between sex work, prostitution, doing dates, and sex trafficking victims?
So to talk about that, we have to kind of say what is differentiate between what is the legal definition, what's the colloquial definition, and what is, you know, all of that. So prostitution is not a word we really use, but it is the legal definition of a person who sells sex. In the legal world, when they say someone is arrested for prostitution, it could be someone who is sex trafficked. It also could be someone who is not. It is becoming more common that someone who's arrested for prostitution is not being sex trafficked, but people who are trafficked are still engaging in the sale of sex for the exchange of money or other goods and services. That's prostitution. And so sex trafficking, you're correct, it has this very, we kind of call it a spectrum, or kind of this very large range of what it can be, because you can have someone who says to their person who's out doing the dates, baby, I'm not going to love you, or I'll leave you if you don't go do a date. But then you'll have someone who is being held hostage and is beaten and raped every single day if they don't do dates. And so those are very different. Both those people are suffering, but those are different experiences. And then you have the underage ones who they exchange sex for anything, shelter, food, a pack of cigarettes. They're considered a trafficking victim because of their age. They're not being forced or anything like that. They're doing it of their own free will, of their own agency, but because of their age, they're considered trafficking victims. When we talk to victims, and which we do all the time, we don't have to know the exact specifics, but getting at where they fall in that range is important, because then it comes down to what you need to do to help them. If they have to escape right then, that is very different from someone who is, you know, not in a situation where it's completely vital that they have to leave at that moment because their life is in danger.
And when a person comes to you and identifies that they're being trafficked, can you kind of walk us through the process that you all do or have, or just the support that you have in place for them?
There is definitely a difference depending on their situation and what we're in that situation, how much money we have, because we're such a small nonprofit. But a lot of the girls don't know they're being trafficked. They think that they're the boyfriend, aka their trafficker, who's beats them every single day and has forced them to have abortions and has been doing this for years and held them captive. That's a normal thing. And so to have them identify first is a big thing. And then if they do identify to us, we try really hard to get them out in that moment. So the first thing we try to do, and Cindy, jump in here if I misspeak here, because this gets very complicated, is we try to get them into stabilization, which is a hotel room. And then once they get stabilized, the question becomes, what happens next? Because they need to get into an aftercare program, or most of the time, housing. Cindy's the one that can talk about that one better than me, because that's more her forte of housing and trying to get people into aftercare programs.
We do an assessment, which is a VSPIDAT, and we send it to the Coalition to End Homelessness, and they get assessed through that program. And if they qualify for permanent supportive housing or not, they get put on a list, which most of the time they do not get called. So that's the first step, is we do a VSPIDAT, find out where they sit on the Coalition to End Homelessness. Depending on where they're at, then we try to get them into either rapid rehousing, permanent supportive housing. And then if we can't do that, if they have Social Security, any kind of income, we try to find an apartment within their price range and then get them into the apartment.
In order to qualify for housing, a Vulnerability Index Service Prioritization Decision Assistance Tool, or in short, what's known as VSBAT, is necessary. Permanent supportive housing, the first housing possibility mentioned, is primarily for people with disabilities. Rapid rehousing is primarily for people who are not disabled. Here's Christine talking about how the administrative or bureaucratic requirements can be barriers for women who are already living on the street.
And so all this gets really complicated if they have kids, you know, so we have trafficking victims with small children and stuff. And or if they have other people that, you know, they have to take care of, a grandma or somebody else. So are they addicted? If they're addicted, that complicates the thing. And they almost of them are. And so a lot of programs will help them only if they agree to get clean or start to become clean or are clean. And that is something that is not, it is, we believe it's unrealistic to ask someone to get clean as soon as they leave trafficking, the situation where they've been held captive and, you know, abused. And they, suddenly we have to tell them, well, in order to get help from us, you've got to get clean. I mean, that's not okay. You don't feel safe in your own home or your own place you're staying. And then, you know, you're not, until you feel there's a little bit of safety, you're not going to feel like I want to get clean, because that coping mechanism, which is what it is, away from them immediately, is not necessarily the best thing for them.
I wanted to go back to the women receiving a phone call. So what happens if they don't have a phone, or they had a phone number, or they, you know, and they lost their phone, or do these organizations then, do they just, they're like, that name drops to the bottom of the list? Do they then contact you all for you to then be like, have you seen this person? What are kind of, are you the in-between to try to find people that possibly are able to get housing at that point, but they just can't be contacted for whatever reason?
We had one lady who has been homeless for over 30 years, and she recently was trafficked by someone where she was trying to find a warm place to stay, safe place to stay. She ended up being trafficked by the guys. And she showed up at Outreach with bruises, footprints on her chest. But she wasn't able to find a place within 30 days with us even trying to help her. We couldn't get her into somewhere for 30 days that would accept the voucher, accept her for not having a place to live in over 30 years. Multiple stuff, you know, play into that. So they dropped her from the program and didn't care if she didn't have nowhere to sleep, didn't have nowhere to go. They just threw her out. They were like, okay, well, you're done. We're not helping you no more. We're vouchers going to someone who's willing to look for an apartment. When she did, we were totally helping her. She was looking. I was looking. Kylea was looking. We were looking for her.
And we physically brought her to go look at, like, we know she was looking. Like,
yeah, because we took her.
She was trying. She was trying so hard.
And so she lost her voucher. We lost contact with her again for a while. And we kind of just go and do driving outreach to look for these women to get them into housing, because they don't have phones. They don't have things to be reached. So we're kind of we put our number down for a contact. And then we go driving around up and down Central, the back roads, everywhere looking for these women to get them where they have to get, to their appointments, to get, you know, wherever they got to go. We try to do this.
At any given time, we have a missing list. So women we haven't seen for several months that we're looking for and making sure they're alive, not in jail, and not dead. And then we have a secondary list of women who we have to find because their housing has come up and we have to figure out how to get them into this place. And then we have a third actual missing list, which is trafficking victims that other groups are looking for. So we have this large, you know, at any given time of people that we're looking for, women who, you know, are in danger for or need help for one reason or another. And so,
yeah, so the lady who we were talking about that has been homeless for 30 some years and was trafficked, we got her an interview with Hope Village,
which is a brand new village that has been created by Hope Works, but we have to get her to the interview. So to get her to the interview and make sure we can go get her, we've been trying to put her in a hotel room just so we can get her to the interview to see if she can get into this place, because otherwise we won't be able to find her. You know, this is just the reality. And there's a lot of things that could fix this.
Yeah. Are you talking on like policy level? Are you talking about like other groups and their own internal policies?
So campuses have emergency phones in case someone gets attacked. Why don't we have those in the international district, aka the war zone, which is called that for a reason.
Or University area where the truck stops are at.
Exactly. And then they can also use that phone to contact and use it as a phone to contact groups. I mean, there's no reason that you can't actually, and then we can use that as a, you know, as a way to get in touch with them when we need to find them. The women that we know who are homeless on the street in tents, there could be the tent communities of that we know are stationary and not being moved constantly by the city that we know where they are and can go find them every day to check on them and then know where to pick them up from. But instead, every single day, the police department will come and make the move. So we can't find our clients that we need to get who are trafficking victims, who are crime victims, and get them into housing. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that could be happening, a lot of cooperation that could be happening that there just isn't, there just aren't conversations about, or they're just non-starters.
This is Where We Meet. I'm Chelsea Reedy. Cindy Jaramillo and Christine Barber are co-founders of Street Safe, an organization that advocates for unhoused women. Street Safe specifically focuses on women who have been trafficked in the sex trade. In this next part, Christine and Cindy talk about Street Safe's harm reduction philosophy. Harm reduction is a term that's been in use since the 1980s to describe a set of practical strategies and ideas aimed at reducing negative consequences associated with drug use. This philosophy is now widely used to describe actions to promote health and safety in the sex working communities. Harm reduction allows organizations to frame their work as helping folks live safer lives without passing judgment on the actions taken by those individuals. Here's Christine Barber.
So harm reduction in and of itself is just a belief that that if people are going to, if people choose to engage in things that could be harmful to them, that we try to provide them the tools they can to be as safe as possible. So what that means for the women we serve specifically who are in the sex trade on the street is right now, if a woman is leaning over a car on Central and talking to the driver in a certain part of town, they will use her gender, location, and her actions of leaning over the car and talking to a man through a car window as enough to arrest her for solicitation. That does not give her. So what the women do instead is when they approach a car to get in to do a date, they have to jump in immediately and have no time to determine if that guy is going to hurt her. And so what could really help is if the police said, we're not going to do that. And that will give the woman time to make a determination is if this guy is the next Wes Mesa killer, the next David Parker Ray, who's going to kill her. Because right now she does not have a choice. So that policy of arresting people for solicitation based on just that is causing harm. Also, you know, giving out condoms, as you know, we give out condoms constantly. That's a very, very small harm reduction thing that we do, which is, you know, let's keep everybody as safe as possible while they do dates. Let's make sure they have all the condoms they need available. So if they ever decide to get out of the life, that they do not have STDs, they do not have HIV, things like that, and the same for the customers. That's how we kind of view harm reduction.
I think one of the more shocking aspects that I don't think a lot of folks realize is the cost. So we can get into the mental, physical, psychological costs, but I mean more of the daily costs of living on the streets. Can you talk a little bit about what costs the women are trying to cover each day?
Well, the biggest cost is, so if you're a female on the street, the safest place, so women are attacked constantly on the street. They have 20 episodes of violence per year compared to 3 for men. Rape is considered a normative experience for homeless women, like it's by researchers, like it's very common. And so staying in a tent is not that safe. And especially when it's cold outside, you're going to want to go indoors. Well, going indoors means a motel. And a motel minimum is going to be $65.
That is somewhere like not in the area of where they can walk out and go do a date to get money. They'd have to travel to get there. On Central, it's anywhere from $80 to $120, depending on the person in the office. If they know you do dates, they jack up the price. There's one motel that jacks up the price. Oh, you have a visitor? $10 every visitor.
And if they know the person's coming to do a date with you, they'll charge you $20 to $30 and they'll take the cash. So they're actually profiting from they know the women in the hotel rooms are doing dates. And so they actually profit from that themselves. Yeah. We know women who wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning to go start doing dates so they can afford their hotel room every single day. And it's, you know, $90 a day for a month. That's $5,000. But they have to do that every single day. And if they don't make their rent, and we call it rent because it's a motel, at 10, 11 o'clock every day and have it turned in, they will kick them out of the motel. They'll open the door.
Or charge them extra for being late.
Or open the door and anybody can come in here, your hotel room, and grab all of your stuff. It is very difficult to find advocacy that'll help us kind of fight those kinds of things.
And then what other costs are they trying to cover after?
Most of them do drugs because they don't want to be high while doing this kind of work. They want to be in a different state of mind. So the drugs, the food.
And the drugs themselves, I mean, and the drugs, can Tim knows more about this than I do, but the drugs themselves are a minimum $80 and you're per day. And so it's like the dates could be anywhere from $20 and up, but how many dates do you have to do to make that $90 plus the $80 plus
laundry,
buy hair conditioner, that kind of stuff? I mean, it's just every single day is nothing but a scramble from morning to night. How do you save money to even think about getting a apartment? Because you need a security deposit. So how do you save $500 doing this every, you know, how do you even put that
plus
together?
Plus first month's rent. And some places require first month's, last month's, and deposit.
And then they're robbed by the customers very commonly. And the money they had earned that day, it'll take one customer to wipe out all of the money they've just earned. Every 2 weeks, women will come to us and say, I just got robbed again by every single thing. And we give them all new clothing. We never ask questions. We're just like, take whatever you need. All new clothing. I'll do everything every time. So there is no getting out of all of that to get your own place is an incredibly difficult task.
And they got to make their money for the room, you know, to make sure they can get to this appointment. So if they did make the money for the room to get the, if we can't afford to pay for the room and they're in a room and we got to get them to an appointment, they got to make their money by the time their appointment hits. If not, they could come back, their door could be open, all their stuff could be gone, or they could be locked out. Have to come back and make the money.
They can charge whatever they decide they want for the room. I mean, there is no one out there saying that they can't do this. So it is really, there are so many things working against them. And then you have women out there who are really, they're trying so hard to do the right thing. So we had a serial rapist, so we had several women who were testifying against him. And we had to make sure that they, in order to get them to go testify, they had to hang out all day in the courtroom because they had to be there all day to be witnesses. Well, they're supposed to, in their life, they have to be out working all day long to make enough money to get enough for their hotel room. They, you know, they were like, I have to get up at 5 a.m. We're like, we will figure out a way to pay for your room because this is, what you're doing is so important. And they really stuck with it. And I give them so much credit for that because they did not. I mean, there's a lot of rape victims out there and they really tried to help the ones that would have suffered if this guy hadn't gone to prison. So
what would you like the surrounding community to understand or know about the women that you serve?
A lot of them are there just because of circumstances that took them there beyond their control. When I was out there and I had to learn how to survive on the streets really young. One way I learned how to survive was to prostitute and to work the streets. And it was because my mother had been killed when I was young by a serial killer. And I had nobody. And I had to learn how to take care of myself, survive, get me motel rooms. And that's how I learned. And that didn't make me a bad person. And so I understand. And I just want the community to know that they're not bad women. A lot of them are the sweetest, nicest, kindest women out there. They're just stuck in the position where they have to do this.
Because what are you supposed to do if your mom starts trafficking you at age 12 and then gives you your first hit of crack at age 13 and that's what you have and that's all you know and you run away from home to escape that, but that's, you haven't been to school since you were 11. And so what are you supposed to do? I mean, we have a client that she went out of her way to, you know, to help with the serial rapist. She went out of her way to testify against him, but she was trafficked by her parent, by her mom. She was, you know, that's how she got addicted. That's how she ended up on the street. Again, we're not trying to paint the women as angels. We're trying to paint them as completely normal human beings. Some of them are really nice. Some of them are terrible, but that is true for all of us. There is nothing inherently wrong or bad with them. And if they are choosing to sell sex to get by, there are a lot of times reasons for that, because if you have been trafficked since you were 12 by your parent and you haven't been in school, how are you supposed to go get a job at McDonald's? McDonald's won't even take you if you have more than one misdemeanor. So people throw these things out there. They could go get a job. Well, they haven't been in school since they were, you know, 12 or 13. How are they supposed to do that if they've never had an actual job? A lot of them have never signed a lease. They have never had a bank account, never anything that we consider potentially normal mainstream stuff is stuff that has not happened for them. And so
some of them have, you know, not everybody that we serve just work central. You know, we're trying to expand and go a lot further than just that little area, you know, that we've been doing. And not a lot of them have put themselves through school dancing. A lot of them have took care of their families, you know, dancing in clubs. You know, that's sex trade. There's a lot, you know, that play into the sex trade, but they get looked at a certain way, even though they're not, but they're taking care of their families, putting themselves through school, doing multiple stuff with doing that. So there's, you know, escorting, there's a lot that play into it, but they get a bad rap because they sell sex. Really, it's the oldest profession out there.
Well, and a lot of the girls will say it's the most honest thing they could possibly do because they're not selling anything that doesn't belong to them. They're only selling what they already have.
You both give a lot of comfort and a friendly and familiar face to the women living on the street. At the outreaches you hold every week, you're greeting the women, giving them hugs, checking in, and caring for them. And having experienced this when I went to a Friday outreach as a volunteer, you both welcomed me in a way that very rarely happens, where it was like I felt very seen and just real, and I could observe you just doing that with every single person that came to the outreach, which I think is just a very special space in itself. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the initial meet that you have with someone new and the importance of chocolate.
The effect of chocolate in meeting someone for the first time in what we do cannot be overstated, especially women who are trafficked. If it's very easy to walk by someone who offers you something. So if we're just offering them a sheet of resources, the women who are trafficked to the men who are trafficked, their traffickers office often watching them, and they know that they're not supposed to deviate. They know they're not supposed to talk to other people. They're not going to talk to you. And so in order to make sure that everyone wants to talk to you, and not only that, you're giving them something that they want, we give out chocolate. And we don't give out just like a piece of chocolate. We give out big handfuls of chocolate. We go through about $100 of chocolate a week, but we do that for a very specific reason, because giving out chocolate like that, where we're giving them a ton of chocolate instead of just one or two pieces, shows that we're not in control of the chocolate. We are actually sharing it. It's not that we're allowing you to have a couple pieces of our chocolate. This is together. We're giving you as much as you can hold. And we say, you can have as much chocolate as you want. There's certain conversational rules that we all kind of know about and follow unconsciously. One of them is, if someone gives you that much chocolate, they have then earned a right to speak to you for a few seconds. So we use those few seconds, and especially for those new trafficking victims or women we haven't met, to give them what we call the bad guy list. And it's the list of all the men who are out hurting women on the street. So the serial rapists, the people who are attacking women as they walk down Central, try to grab them and pull them into cars. Unfortunately, I put a new list up every single week. And on that list, on the back of it, is information for how trafficking victims can get help. So we have then just done a couple of things with their trafficking victims. We've gotten them to stop and say hi and see that we're not scary. I might be scary sometimes, but Cindy's never scary. to see that, you know, we're friendly and we want to give them a bunch of chocolate, which everyone usually wants a bunch of chocolate. And then we've also given them really important information to stay safe, because we list the cars, descriptions of the cars for them to stay away from, because they might get attacked. And then lastly, for our own purposes, we have then given them information. If they ever feel like they want to get out of the life, they now have at least something that they have read that says you can get out of the life this way. And they might, you know, even if they're from out of town, trafficked, and we never see them again, they might remember those women in Albuquerque who were so nice to them and think, okay, their people do exist who do care. And that's really important.
And how can, does everyday citizens just around Albuquerque support those living on the street, besides supporting all of you?
Driving down Central, if you see women who are out doing dates, just accept that they're people and don't worry about it. And none of this needs, it doesn't, their lifestyle does not need to concern you at all. You don't need to make a comment under your breath or to your buddy or your friend who's in the seat next to you.
Or throw eggs at them.
Or throw eggs at them or other stuff.
Or paintballs.
Or rocks or anything. And you don't need to say to your buddy next to you, oh, look at that hooker or whatever. And again, I hate that term.
Or put them on TikTok.
Yeah, exactly. Make fun of them on TikTok and take pictures. I mean, you don't need to do all of that. all, you just leave them alone. They're doing their own life. You let them live their own life, but you can also just be kind. That's all we ask is just kindness.
A smile and a kind word goes a long way.
Exactly. And if you want to do more than that, you can always contact us or other groups that are involved with helping the women in the sex trade and just be like, how can I do more? Just understanding that if you see a woman on the street who is selling sex, there's a really good chance, an 86% chance that she's a trafficking victim and that she has been forced to at some point to do that or started underage. And so have some compassion.
A special thank you to Cindy Jaramillo and Christine Barber for sharing their experience and their efforts and the stories of the women that they work with. If you'd like to contribute, volunteer, or donate to Street Safe, details are on their website, streetsafenewmexico.org. And if you are in Taos, New Mexico, Heart of Taos is a nonprofit committed to empowering Taos women who are experiencing homelessness. Where We Meet comes from Taos Center for the Arts in Taos, New Mexico, and is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Producers include Colette LaBeouf, Chelsea Reedy, Alice Morion, Ariana Cubillos-Vogler, and Joshua Aragon. Research and writing by Jacqueline Paul. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. On Where We Meet, we share conversations from New Mexico and beyond. Thanks for listening. Be well.